caught a plane. Catch an airplane? All right. All right. Well, I am here to talk to you about two things today. I am here to talk to you about traffic safety. And I'm also here to talk to you about the role that municipal courts play, not only in our community, but in our judicial system. This is kind of a multi-dimensional presentation in the sense that for those of you who are relatively new, this is going to give you kind of a big picture of what this is all about. For those of y'all who are seasoned veterans, this is going to be a good opportunity to revisit some basic tenets. So let me ask you, first of all, how many of you have been working in municipal court for less than 3 years? 3 years or less. All right. Let's see 3 to 6. 3 to 6. Okay. Let's go ahead and do, 6 to 9. Okay. And let's go ahead and do more than 10. More than 10. All right. Now let's go ahead and just make this simple. Less than 10. Less than 10. More than 10. Okay. Now I'd like you to each touch your nose with your left hand and begin counting backwards from 5. No, that's all right. All right. Just want to put this into context. I'm here to talk to you about why traffic safety matters. And I want to start off with you. I want to ask you a question. This is interesting. How many of you have, in the last 6 to 9 months, have either seen or read an article about someone being killed in an automobile? And I'm curious, why do you remember this? Of all the things, you know, this with the passage of time, why do these things stand out in your mind? What are the factors about these stories that make them memorable? They're usually teenagers, okay? We sit there, and let me ask you, she said, they're usually teenagers. That's right. You know, in terms of the most dangerous drivers on the road, you know that youthful drivers rank right up there. This is a scary fact, and it's especially scary if you are a parent of a teenager. How many of you are parents of teenagers? Let's see hands. All right, this is a very scary fact, and I'm not, you know, a child, a young driver, is most likely to be killed or to kill someone else during their first 500 hours of operating a motor vehicle. How many of you have heard that statistic before? The first 500 hours, they are most likely to kill themselves or to kill or seriously injure someone else. Okay, and so that's one reason why these stand out, because we sit there and we think about it. What else? What other thing is it about it? What other factors make these stories memorable? Alcohol is involved. Sometimes you hear that people are text messaging or trying to, you know, use electronic gizmos while driving. I have to be honest with you, we live in an increasingly distracted society. How many of you text message? Do you text message? Not, okay, well, I'm not going to ask anyone to make that to incriminate themselves, though I have to tell you it's not illegal yet. We've had efforts this session. Apparently, we're not quite there yet. We're not quite ready to say that we think that the government has a legitimate, compelling interest in public safety to criminalize people's decisions to text message while operating a motor vehicle. Wow. We're not there yet. But I also want to remind you, we were the last state in the union to have a seatbelt law. We were the second to the last. No, we were absolutely the last state as well to have an open container law. And how else can I put it? Sometimes change comes slow in the great state of Texas. All right, I'm not sure if it's that we really love our text messaging. We know we love we know we love other things. We know we love football. You know, what do you think? Do you think the average Texan has even discovered text messaging at this point in time? I don't know. I guarantee you. My grandmother hasn't. That's all I'm saying. Okay. Other reasons why we tend to remember these stories is because of the media. I mean, think about it. How do you hear about these? How many of these cases, when you think about a story in which someone was killed in an automobile, the reason you know about it is because someone told you? There's going to be a lot of folks, especially in small town communities. But so raise your hand, it's because you have firsthand knowledge. How many of you know about it because you heard about it on the radio, you saw it on television, or you read about it in a newspaper? Okay, and this goes back to another kind of scary realization about our society, right? If it bleeds, it leads. How many of you have heard that before? How many of you think that's a true statement? That there is an effort by the media to shock us? Hopefully, sometimes that shock is in our best interest. All right. So we focus on vehicular homicide. Vehicular assault. How many of you in the last year or so can recall a situation in which a person was not killed, but was rather seriously injured by another person who was operating a motor vehicle? Okay. How many of you personally know of someone who was seriously injured by another person operating a motor vehicle? Okay. Well, once again, what are the characteristics? Why do we remember these things? Why do we focus on this and it becomes a big deal? There's tragedy involved, especially when you hear about like the one that y'all have probably seen, the PSA, a horrible, horrible incident in which a young woman was burned, and a beautiful young woman who was burned as a consequence of an individual who was driving while intoxicated. How many of y'all have seen the PSAs on this that are being used here in the state of Texas? Let me give you another one. Something that Kathy did not mention is I am from Vernon, Texas. How many of you know where Vernon, Texas is? All right. Well, God bless you. Okay. And I have to tell you that there was there's a truck stop right outside of Vernon, heading towards Wichita Falls, near Oakley Union and Herald is where this thing's located. And this truck stop became famous as being the location of where every year we would have someone who was either killed or seriously injured. Because this is what would happen. A truck would pull out onto the road, and if y'all know how a big rig operates, it takes a while to gear these things up. You're not going 0 to 60 in 4.2 seconds. It's not like you're driving a Porsche or anything. And while the people were gearing up, because of the trajectory, the angle, the view of the drivers coming down the road, that were heading, they were heading kind of northbound from Wichita Falls, what would happen is it would kind of create like this mirage where people could see the truck, but they had no ability to perceive how fast the vehicle was moving. And as a result, every year we would have someone who would run up underneath an 18-wheeler, run up underneath the trailer of this. By the way, how many of y'all have even heard of this truck stop? This is kind of a legendary truck stop up in North Texas. Kind of, you've been there. All right. So this is one of those things. Now they have, if you're driving there, you can see these amber lights that you can see them from almost a mile away. Okay, and that's another reason, because we think about people getting hurt, being injured. Sometimes it's by the negligence or the acts of others or circumstances. But it also has to do with the location. How many of you, it's like when you're driving to work, you say, you know what, this is where so-and-so died, or this is where so-and-so was injured. How many of y'all can think of a similar situation? It's almost like, people used to call it, dead man's curve. They'd even think sometimes it had to do with just the way that the road was set up. All right. So we think about vehicular assault. All right. These things get ample attention, correct? Next up. Go back. Whoop. Reckless driving. Let me ask you something. How about reckless driving? How many of you have read a story about this? Does reckless driving get as much attention as death and serious bodily injury? Are she saying yes? How many of y'all say that they think that it gets ample attention, that it gets fair, that it gets equal media attention, and where someone has to be? It almost tends to be, I don't know, at least it seems to me anyway, that people actually do have to be seriously injured, deformed, or, God forbid, killed before it reaches that level of attention. But let me ask you something. How many of you have seen in the last year and a half, you've seen someone who, in your opinion, was engaged in reckless driving? You've seen it. Okay. Every day. Reckless driving is a Class B misdemeanor in Texas. Now, it's not a fine-only offense. It is punishable by a term of incarceration. And, what is it? You may remember, it's kind of a goofy one. It's like a $500 fine and I think a period of incarceration not to exceed, I think it's 5 days. Kathy, do you recall? I think it's 5 days or 10 days. It has some jail time attached to it, but reckless driving is almost what I like to call a class B minus misdemeanor. Okay, which brings us to speeding. Okay, do I even dare ask the question? Have any of you seen someone in the last 30, 45 minutes, depending on what time you arrived at the hotel? How many of you have seen someone engage in speeding in the last 6 to 9 months? Have any of you not seen anyone speeding in the last year? Okay. Now, you might be asking, where am I going with all this? Why are we talking like this? What's the point of this? And here is the point. The point is that we tend to have, as human beings, we tend to have a natural tendency to engage in tunnel vision. We tend to focus on what is at hand, at the issue that's in front of us. Okay? Kids wreck the car. What do? You focus on the wrecked car. Do you focus on the cause of the wrecked car? No, we tend to focus on what happened. Why did you wreck that car? How are we going to fix that car? No, you're not getting another car. Don't talk to me. Get to stepping. Okay? But the reality of the matter is, these behaviors are not separate islands in an ocean. They're one continuum. Think about this. For a person to engage in reckless driving, they have to be in an automobile. And they have to engage in speeding. Okay? Or at least they don't have to, but they likely are engaged in speeding. And think about how many accidents we have in which people are either injured or killed, that it all begins with the rate at which the automobile is being operated, the speed. All right? And that's the point of this. The point of the matter is that we can choose as a society to focus on, we can hold on to a sinking stone until the worst is known. Or we can actually decide as a society and as a community that we're not going to allow the worst to happen first and then to do something about it. Because guess what? Our children will be dead, our family members and our friends will be injured, and that is simply unacceptable. Okay? And so that's the point of this. The whole notion of preventing the greater harm. And that's what I start off with. What does it mean to prevent the greater harm? What it means in simplest terms, and now I'm actually using the interactive notes, what does it mean? It means that we're not going to wait for the worst to happen. We believe there are things that can be done to stop the worst from occurring. All right. There are powers in numbers, and I want to share some numbers with you today. I want to talk to you about how, because I think that there is another natural tendency we have as human beings, is we tend to feel like what we do at our jobs occurs in a vacuum. I mean, I think that one of the reasons why folks enjoy coming to TMCEC conferences is because they get to talk to people from other towns and they get to see faces and they get to hear stories and questions, and it reminds them that they are not the only person who has a question about, which DIC form do you use? Or, is there a reporting code for X, Y, or Z? Okay, there's a sense of camaraderie. I want to talk to you about how there's a sense of camaraderie in what you do by working in a municipal court. So let me give you some numbers that I want you to think about, and I want you to take them back and share them with your city council, with your city manager, and with your municipal judge. First of all, municipal courts constitute 34% of the Texas judicial system. 34%. If you include the justice of the peace courts, municipal and justice courts constitute, ready for this, 60% of the entire Texas judicial system. Secondly, municipal judges constitute 38% of the Texas judiciary. In other words, if we were to get every judge in the state of Texas, the municipal judges would have a plurality vote. Municipal judges constitute 44% of judges in Texas who are attorneys. And I want to put this into context, too. In other words, this is something that might surprise you, but how many of you were aware of the fact that if we were to take all of the judges, once again, in the state of Texas, and put them in, an arena, okay, that they would probably be the worst basketball players you've ever seen. No, I'm just joking. When I said arena, my mind went crazy for a second. I started thinking about Reunion Arena in Dallas. Now I'm thinking about Bruce Springsteen in 92 at the arena in Dallas. Come back, Ryan. Come back. You're in Odessa. Okay. The fact of the matter is that if you were to take all the judges, I'm talking about Court of Criminal Appeals judges, all the members of the Court of Appeals, all of our district court judges, all of our county judges, all of our JPs, all of our municipal judges, and we were to put them all in a room, and we were to say, all right, attorneys to the left, non-attorneys to the right. Believe it or not, there are actually more non-attorney judges in this state than there are attorney judges. Now, if we were to look to the side of the arena, I'm sorry, I'm still having too much fun. Now I'm starting to think about Mark Cuban and the Dallas Mavericks. I guess we're no longer in Reunion Arena. Now what, we're in the American Airlines Center. I need to move. I need to get with the times. Reunion Arena is so old school. How 1990s of me to be thinking about Reunion Arena. Okay. If we were to now say, okay, attorneys to the left, non-attorneys to the right, and we were to turn our attention to the attorneys and say, all right, municipal judges, this side, everyone else this side. 44% of those lawyers standing in that on the side with municipal judges, it was 44% of them. So in other words, the municipal judges who have bar cards constitute a plurality of all the attorney judges in the state of Texas. That's another interesting fact. All right, how about the non-attorneys? Municipal judges who are non-attorneys constitute 41% of all non-attorney judges in the state. This is another interesting fact because it also is kind of indicative of a trend that we've seen at the center. I'm not sure if I'm supposed to say I'll be celebrating my 10-year anniversary, Hope, in September, or will I say that I have, oh, yes, sir, yeah, celebrating. I guess it's celebrating. She's clapping before I can come up with my second line, which is, or I have survived 10 years at the Texas Municipal Courts Education Center. But I'll tell you a trend that I've seen. When I came to work for the center, and this was in 1999, the ratio of attorneys to non-attorneys was 52% non-attorney, 48% attorney. And in the last year, we've seen that switch. There, it's now 52% of the municipal judges in the state are attorneys, and 48% are non-attorneys. Now, I have to say that of the non-attorney audience, we have some of the most diverse non-attorney judges in the state. We've got PhDs, we've got school teachers, we've got retired police officers, we've got, taxidermist, we've got librarians, we have people from all walks of life, okay? And this is another, I personally value the diversity that all these judges, these experiences that these people bring to the bench. I think these are all very good things. In 2007, Texas Municipal Courts adjudicated, you ready for this? 6,743,230 cases. 6,743,230 cases. Now be honest with me. How many of you sometimes feel like you had to adjudicate all 6,743,200? How many of you feel like sometimes you have that type of day, okay, where it just seems like it's never going to end? It's just never going to end. Put that into context. That is population of Houston, Texas, a little over 1.5 million. All right, 6 million. I mean, what is the population of the state of Texas? Anybody know? Someone, give me a guess. Come on. I'm trying to think about this. I think last time I saw, I think the population of the state of Texas was roughly, was I think 18 million in the last census, I think somewhere in that ballpark. Well, you know, we're saying a third of everyone in the state at any given year has a good chance, has a probability of having their day in municipal court. Okay, we come in contact with more people than all other Texas courts combined. That's something you need to remember. Now, it might be that your court's like the court that I work part-time in, a very small, low-volume court in Dripping Springs, Texas. And last year, I always see these numbers, I go, oh, yeah, you see that 6,743,230? Yeah, we're responsible for 87 of those, okay? And you might feel that way, too. But I want to remind you that in the aggregate, you know, once again, step back for a second. Keep in mind that what we all do is related. It's all of it's important. And that what what each of you do individually is perceived collectively. It's perceived collectively. All right. Trials. Y'all ready for this? Wow. 2007, Texas Municipal Courts, according to the Office of Court Administration, conducted 1,225,561. Yes, we're a little shy of having provided a trial for every resident of the city of Houston, which is one of the largest cities in the United States of America, but we're working on it. We're working on it. Maybe we can have more trials next year to hit that 1.5 million. Now, I need to also clarify this. The way OCA does data, if you make your first appearance and you don't plead guilty, or if you do anything but plea out, they calculate that as setting it for trial. And as y'all know, how many of you have seen this? How many of you have had folks who go, oh yeah, I'm going to fight this. I'm going all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. I am here to fight like you do not know. And then they say they're going to fight, and then something happens on the way to the opera. By the time it's time to tee up and have trial, they're like, wah, 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 I got nothing. I'm ready to go home. How many of you have seen those defendants before? That's a real common phenomenon. You got to be careful. Every now and then you will really get one of those defendants who will fight you all the way to the end of the earth. Believe it or not, I was just telling Hope, I have a case that I prosecuted 3 years ago that started off in municipal court. We're getting ready to file PDRs in the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. Okay? And so it happens. It does happen. All right. Okay, gatekeeping functions. I want to talk to you about magistrate duties. How many of you, your municipal judges, are regularly involved in performing magistrate duties there in your county? When you are a magistrate, you're not you do it by virtue of your position as municipal judge, but you're actually a county magistrate. You're not a city magistrate. All right, so let's talk about some numbers on this. Number of search warrants issued, 5,368. There's a very fine line between a home invasion and a properly executed search warrant. Search warrants, yes, they've been known to affect how people feel about their day. You know, let's talk about the number of arrest warrants issued. This is another staggering number. 2,454,665. Folks, that's a lot of warrants. That's a lot of arrests. It's a lot of arrest fees. That's a lot of returns. That's a lot of paperwork. That's a lot of filing, okay? Magistrate warnings given, 274,567. Emergency mental commitments, not many of these happen. How many of you know what I'm talking about when I'm talking about emergency mental commitment?
We had a guy come in and he wanted to get a permit for human execution.
He wanted to get a permit for human execution, and instead he got an emergency mental commitment. This is your lucky day. You are the 15th customer. And you appear to be touched.
We have a really big fire marshal. He was so excellent. He goes, well, you know, we don't give out a lot of those, so I called the county sheriff to come over and have those with that.
Okay, well, this is interesting. I mean, you know, it is kind of, sometimes we laugh because it's funny, and we laugh because it's sad. I mean, it's one of those things. Let me ask you something. How many of you, your court, y'all have issued an emergency mental commitment? Have you? How many of y'all don't know what I'm talking about? Okay. It's a magistrate function. Y'all need to know about this. You really do, because it might be the person who you're going to save. It might be a friend or a family member. What it is if an individual has threatened to hurt themselves or to hurt someone else, and a credible person will swear and attest to this, magistrate can issue this writ, this emergency mental commitment order, which essentially, it's an arrest warrant. I mean, you seize the person, and the person has to be observed by in a mental health facility, I think for a period of 48 hours. And that gives gives people enough time to go to county court, typically your probate judge, to get a longer duration observation order. So, you know, especially for those of us who have had people in our lives who have died through suicide and things like this is a very important order. The problem is it's typically too late. But, you know, no one, you know, you never see it coming, and that's kind of the downside. We issued 2,078 emergency mental commitments in 2007. Okay, the last one, I'm sure, you know, some of you may not have heard of the emergency mental commitment. I bet you every one of you have heard of magistrate's order of emergency protection. How many of you have heard of the magistrate's order of emergency? How many of you have been involved in handling the paperwork on magistrate's order of emergency protection? It really does scare me. You know, the problem we have in our state, issues of domestic violence, things that we have, you know, dating violence, things of this nature, and we issued 8,847 magistrate's orders of emergency protection last year. By the way, just a little sidebar note. How many of y'all have actually seen citations written for Class C assault family violence? How many of you have seen that? The Texas legislature passed a bill on this. I'll just let y'all know. Get ready to reprint your tickets. Get ready to reprint your tickets. And if you're about to print tickets, don't do it. Not until you've gone to legislative update. You're going to have new verbiage on all of your citations, specifically if it relates to Class C assault family violence. Okay. All right. Gatekeeping function continuing on. Children in the courtroom. Okay. And let's talk about this. This is, you know, we talk about this notion of the gatekeeper. We understand how it applies in the context of the magistrate. We also play a significant gatekeeping function as it relates to children. Okay. Let me ask you this something. This is a true or false question. For the last decade, juvenile courts have adjudicated the vast majority of children accused of criminal conduct. Is that true or false? You say false? How many of y'all say true? Say, let's see a show of hands. How many say true? How many of y'all say false? How many of you say I'm not participating in the democratic process? All right. Actually, that's not only false, it's so false it set off my alarm. Would that wake you up? Oh, yeah. It should wake you up. Make you run to the stairs? That's not only false. That is, it's super false. It is so incredibly false, it's worthy of our description. Okay, we need to talk about this. This is something else. I need your help. I need you to tell your friends and tell your family members. Make sure they understand something. Those county and district courts that have been designated juvenile courts have the name juvenile court. Okay? It's not because we're saying that they act juvenile. That's their designation. Okay? But, boy, in terms of the courts that actually see juveniles, they're not the juvenile court. If that title is something you earn based off of volume, they are not the juvenile courts. Okay. No, municipal and justice courts are. And this continuum that I've presented for you explains to you what I'm talking about. Now, if you've never seen this before, I'm going to teach you a couple of new words. You can go back, you know, impress your friends and family. Okay, or bore them to tears. And one of the things I want to talk to you about is every time you see something in yellow, this is criminal. It's criminal activity down here on this continuum. Everything in the center here is civil. And this is something that you may not have known. One of the reasons why on the last slide, let's go back here for a second. One of the reasons why this is a false statement is because juvenile courts have no authority to adjudicate any criminal conduct. They can't. They are not criminal courts. The only thing they can adjudicate are civil matters that are called one of two things. They're either called delinquent conduct or child in need of supervision. How many of y'all have actually worked or are somewhat familiar with the juvenile justice system we have in the state of Texas? Anyone? All right, one. Let me talk to you about this. First of all, certified felonies. Anybody know what a certified felony is? A certified felon is a child who has committed such a heinous act, okay? And it has to be a certain crime. Typically, it's aggravated sexual assault, capital murder, okay? Things of that nature. And it has to occur in the last 2 years of their adolescence. In other words, it has to occur between the ages like 14 and 16. Because, you know, once you're 17, are you a child when you're 17 years old? Not for purposes of criminal prosecution. You're not. You are an adult, okay? So, 14 to 16. Thank goodness this is a small number, but the number is still surprisingly, it's still scary. In 2007, there were 231 certified cases. In other words, they started off they were filed in juvenile court, but the juvenile court made a determination that because of the person's age and because of what they were alleged, that they should stand trial as an adult, and they were transferred over. That's a certified felony. Now, CHINs. How many of y'all know what CHINs is? You ever heard of this? This is a term you really need to know. CHINs is, sometimes it's called conduct in need of supervision, okay? It really should be called child indicating need for supervision, okay? And this is what it is. CHINs is one of two things. It's either conduct that's just not a good idea. That means in other words, it's not necessarily illegal, but it's something that is so bad for the child that child needs to be supervised by the judicial system. Okay, and let me give you some examples. Can any of y'all think of something that's not illegal, that's just not, that's readily accepted as being bad for children, that would fall in the category of chins? And don't say SpongeBob SquarePants, because that is not a correct answer. Running away from home. Running away from home is the textbook example of chins. Here's the thing. We had a bill even this session where someone tried to make it illegal to run away from home. And that bill, it gets filed every 2 years, and it gets killed in the legislature every 2 years. Can anybody tell me, can anybody make an argument as to why it's a good thing that that bill gets killed every 2 years? I'll tell you, because sometimes a child should run away from home. That's why. Because if you have a child who's being molested, or if you have a child who's being neglected, you know, as human beings, we have an innate sense of self-preservation. We want to live. We want to survive. And so so a child who runs away from home could be determined to be chins by a juvenile court. Okay? Now, that's one thing. Let me give you another one. Huffing paint. Not sure if you're a big fan of it. Not sure if any of you on your, Facebook page you've subscribed to. My interests include huffing paint. But huffing paint, believe it, it's not illegal to huff paint. It's not illegal. It is illegal to sell paint, aerosol paint fumes. It's illegal to sell them to kids. Y'all probably even have, how many of y'all have ordinances regulating selling aerosol paint in your community? Okay, it's a Class C misdemeanor under state law, and your city could have additional ordinances regulating, like do you have to have a driver's license, things of that nature. But it can be, even under a city ordinance. Your city could make it illegal for a child to possess aerosol paint or for a parent to leave aerosol paint accessible to a child. Those are all things that could happen. And here's the thing. I mean, if any of y'all have any, anecdotal stories to share about paint huffing, you know it's not just limit anything that has fumes, it could be huffed.
Ready whip.
Huh? Ready whip, we had people who were getting killed with those. That's called poppers, is what, people use the propellant in an aerosol can, put it to their nose. Well, I know of a child who died. Because the propellant inside these cans, they're called poppers, is kind of the street term for it. You get this, how many of y'all have heard of this? Poppers, it's a quick rush. You take it and you put it into your airway and you hold it down just for the period of time that you absolutely obstruct your airflow. This falls into the same category of stupid as like boys when they were in gym class would squeeze each other till they blacked out and they peed themselves. Not that ever happened in Vernon High School. I'm not saying we did that during off-season, during sports, but I'm just saying, theoretically, if someone was to... Look, young people do stupid things. Anybody want to argue that against that position? Anybody? Anyone? No one's taking me up on my offer today. All right. It's just one of those things that's just not a good idea, and it is absolutely dangerous. It is absolutely dangerous. Let me say this, but here's the other thing. I'm sorry, I got a soapbox. This is my last time to give this speech. I'm throwing everything in I've been saving up all year. When I was prosecuting in Kendall County, we had a guy who we found, he was charged with public intoxication, and that's what he's charged with. And I said, I don't think he's intoxicated on alcohol. And the sheriff said, well, why do you think that? We found him passed out in the front yard of the grocery store. And I was like, possibly it's because in his mugshot he has this big-ass gold ring around his face, where it is suggests to me as a prosecutor that perhaps the man was huffing paint. And no joke, he had a coffee can, he filled it up with paint, he is huffing this bad boy, and at the end he's got this big gold ring. That poor guy, it took him like 6 weeks to get that thing off of his face. Okay? So anyway, I got to be honest with you, I was tempted to keep the picture. It was funny. I mean, I'm sorry, that's funny. Okay, some guy with a big gold ring on his face is funny. All right, now, the second category of chins ought to hit home with you. Believe it or not, it's any fine-only misdemeanor involving a child with two exceptions, traffic and tobacco. So every single Class C misdemeanor case that your court has adjudicated, excluding your traffic and tobacco cases, could have been filed in juvenile court. And they would have had to have filed it as a Chins case. Okay. Now, the number of Chins petitions filed throughout the entire state of Texas in 2007, 1,413. Folks, that just does not look right to me. You're trying to tell me I would think we had more than one, in a state as large as Texas, I would think that we had more people than that run away from home. You're trying to tell me that the number of cases that were Class C misdemeanors other than traffic or tobacco that got filed in juvenile court, 1,413? That's what I'm telling you. All right, anybody want to guess what delinquent conduct is? Nope, delinquent conduct would still be, school attendance would still be Chins. That would still be a Class C misdemeanor. That's another example, thank you. Something that's just not a good idea, not going to school. That's Chins. You know, truancy is dead in this state. No one files truancy charges. I mean, I'm trying to get you and your judges to stop calling what you're hearing in your court truancy. Why am I trying to do it? Because that's Chins and that goes to juvenile court. What do y'all hear? Failure to attend school cases and parent contributing to non-attendance. Not parent contributing to truancy, parent contributing to non-attendance. That's the real name. All right. So what do you think delinquent conduct is? If we've already ruled out, it would be, you're on it. You're on the right track. It's everything else that's not Chins that would be illegal. So in other words, anything that if you or I were to do it, it could result in a term of incarceration. So in other words, something that would be a Class B misdemeanor like DWI, or Class A misdemeanor like assault, or state jail felony like possession of less than 2 grams of cocaine, or a third degree felony like burglary of a habitation, or a second degree felony like attempted murder, or a first degree felony like sexual assault, or capital murder, killing a police officer. Okay, all of that would be delinquent conduct. Now, number of delinquent conduct petitions that were filed in Texas in 2007, 51,602. Slightly larger than the population of the University of Texas at Austin, a little bigger than Texas A&M. Okay, 51,000. That's a little scary, isn't it? Let me ask you something, because I want to make sure I'm also, I don't think Kathy mentioned this, most of you also know I teach college. I teach at St. Edward's University, and I've been teaching there for quite a while. And I always remind my students of this. Can anyone who is found, first of all, you can't even find these people guilty. You have to have a petition, and the petition is either found true or not true. They have all these similar but not the same words that they use in the juvenile justice system. Can you send a kid who's adjudicated in a juvenile court, can you send them to prison? Nope. Can you send them to jail? Nope. Can you fine them? Nope. Why? Because prison, jails, and fines are all part of what? The criminal justice system. And I've already told you, our juvenile justice system is civil, and they don't use those things. No, in fact, what is the worst thing that can happen to you if the petition's found true for delinquent conduct? Y'all know the answer to this. I know you do. If you read newspapers, you know the answer to this. Nope, it's worse than that. Come on, folks. What's been the big scandal we've had in the last year in the state of Texas regarding what state agency that's responsible for the... That's a scandal in and of itself, CPS. No, TYC, the Texas Youth Commission. Remember our state schools, Peyote, okay. I'm sorry, I slipped. It's been a long day. Oh, wait, no, I just woke up. Wait, maybe I'm still sleeping. Okay. So you know what I'm saying? We have, okay, you get sent to Victory Field. Anybody know where Victory Field is? Vernon, Texas. Dun, dun, dun. It's another TYC facility, okay. So in other words, when you hear about, and the reason I say this, I was so bothered to hear the media repeatedly say, prisons for children. We don't have prisons for children. Have any of y'all ever been to a TYC facility? I'm not saying like when they sent you to TYC when you were a kid. I'm talking about like have you ever visited one? It's actually, these things appear to be more like junior college campuses than anything else, all right? Okay, so that brings us down to this end. So if you've had 231, 14, 13, 51,602, how many Class C misdemeanors do you think we're talking about here? Well, maybe not millions. Okay, maybe not millions. That's, you know, keep in mind, I've already given you the numbers for how many municipal court cases were adjudicated. It couldn't be millions. Might feel like millions. How many of these cases make you feel like? How many of you think that the juvenile, your juvenile dockets take more energy out of your soul than anything else you have to do? Okay. All right. 2007, the number of Class C misdemeanors, 163,390. 163,390. Is that a significant number? Well, exactly. Okay. Yeah. Okay. But here's the thing. So you're assuming that we're talking traffic. And here's the thing. I feel like I'm doing an infomercial. If you call right now in the next 2 hours, I'll also throw in two extra ShamWows or whatever the heck that thing's called. No, believe it or not, this number up here excludes every traffic case filed in the state of Texas. In other words, that 163,000 number I'm giving you, that's all non-traffic. That's drug paraphernalia. That's disorderly conduct. That's disruption of class. That's criminal mischief. Okay? That's curfew. That is MIP. But guess what? I've also, if you call in the next 20 minutes, I've also excluded every DUI case involving minors that have been filed. Okay, there are 3,261 cases. Is that a substantial number now? Okay, and guess what? Did I also mention I have excluded every justice of the peace filing? You are only looking at the numbers for municipal court. I have completely eliminated every filing involving a child in justice court. If you were to add in the justice, and let's do the math on this. We're looking at what, 300,000 plus cases involving children? The justice courts roughly would have about a third of that. But you add that together, we're now hovering at a little under 500,000. We're at 400,000 plus cases involving children. So who are the juvenile courts really in this state? The municipal and justice courts are really the juvenile courts in this state, and they have been since the late 90s. All right. Okay, I want to talk to you about why this is important. How many of y'all have ever heard of this notion of training the offender? Have you ever heard of this? Okay, any of y'all ever had a psychology class before? Anybody ever taken like college level psychology, intro to psychology? Okay, this is actually photographs from a now classic study that was done by a psychologist. His name is Albert Bandura, and Albert Bandura is kind of one of the fathers of environmental learning theory. In other words, that we learn from the world around us. How do we make sense of things? And what he did is, this was at a time they were trying to figure out how young people's impressions of the world are formed, and they were very interested at the time about how do children learn to become violent, and how do they know, you know, are children born violent, you know, or, you know, are they just born evil? Is it their environment? Is it a combination of environment and their biology? These are always the questions we've had. So what they did in this, and these are actual photos that I found that I was able to pull up off the internet of them doing this actual study. What they did is they put a child that had two separate rooms, and in one room they had a child who was watching a television. And the television had a video feed into the next room. And in the other room was another child with what they called the Bobo doll. Okay, and the Bobo doll, what you have here is you have a situation where this child, as you can tell, is just pummeling the hell out of this Bobo doll. First of all, the adult, you know, and I think actually this one they had the adult pummel the Bobo doll. And then what they did next is they then had the boy go into the same room, they close the door, and they leave him on. There's different things he can do. There are different activities that he could do. And you know what that child decided to do? Exactly what he, to beat up the Bobo doll, just like he saw on television. Okay. Now, some of you can say, well, that's a mouthful. Why don't you just say monkey see, monkey do, and get to the chase? Okay. Most of y'all who have kids know what the danger is of letting, I know this. I got like my son's three. Okay. I let my kid, you know, I'm a big Star Wars fan. He gets to watch Star Wars. my kid will wail on you with his lightsaber. He has seen one too many episodes of Star Wars. He gets that lightsaber. Doesn't matter if you're 80 and you use a cane. There is a chance that my child will strike you down just like Obi-Wan would, okay? I mean, he is in it with that lightsaber, okay? And stay tuned. More Star Wars references to come. So this is training the offender. Why does it matter to us? What does this mean? What it means is you might not be watching them, and you might be thinking about lunch. You might be thinking about what you're going to do tonight or tomorrow or this weekend. But when you're moving these cases involving children, believe it or not, they're watching you and they're learning from you. And what happens in your court is setting the tempo of what their expectation is of the judicial process. Now, I'm not saying this means you need to go in there and scare the hell out of them or act unprofessional. But if you convert this into an experience that is the same as, I don't know, buying a Dr. Pepper at the Allsup's at the convenience store. Okay, by the way, I'm not sure if I can use an Allsup's reference this far out in West Texas. If you are from the North Texas area between like Abilene, Wichita Falls, and Vernon, I am completely licensed to use Allsup's references. And if you're really bold, go eat an Allsup's burrito. Okay, but what I'm saying is what we do affects these people's impressions. Okay, they're watching you. This is not supposed to be no big deal. Okay, this is not supposed to be no big deal. If our attitude is, of course you got a class C, you know, of course you got a citation, everyone gets a citation. Of course you got caught with drug paraphernalia, everyone gets caught with drug paraphernalia. Let me ask you something. When you were growing up, what would have happened if you got caught with drug paraphernalia? Would the court have been the least of your worries? I didn't only have a dad who would have kicked my ass. I had a dad, a stepdad, a mom, and a stepmom who would have all taken turns kicking my ass. Okay? And that's what I'm saying. How many of you, be honest now, how many of you move so many files that it wears you down? After a period of time, you look at that and you don't see cases, you don't see people, you see paper. You just think, I got one more case, one more file. I want to remind you, these files involve people, and every now and then, you'll have a wake-up call. How many of you have had this happen? How many of you have had someone come to municipal court and they're crying because they're scared? How many of you have seen these people? And why are they crying? All of you almost have. Why are they crying? Why are they scared? Because they've never been to court before. And for you, why is this no big deal? Because you feel like you're trapped in a salt mine. That's why. You feel like you've been living in a salt mine. Okay? And you do this every day. Well, and some of them may. If you've got a judge who's been around the block a couple times or two, that ain't going to happen. But, you know, I guess we do what, you know what Dr. Phil would tell us? We do what works for us. That would be what he says. Yes, ma'am. Well, that's true. Sometimes the parents are a part of the problem. Apple didn't fall too far from the tree, right? But I think that might possibly so. Let me also say this, though. How many of you have also, I worked as a prosecutor for the Austin Municipal Court. We did this thing called Saturday Weekend Court to see if we could lower our FTAs. And I was stunned to see that we actually had parents who showed up with their Sunday school clothes on. How many of you have seen people when they come to court, they dress up? How many of you have noticed that? Okay? That's true. And how many of you also had people dressed up like, I don't know, hookers? Okay. All right. Okay, can we back up the tape on that last part? Just back that up and let's get ready. And how many of you have seen people who wear their Sunday school clothes to court? That's my point. Yeah, people dress differently, and the experiences that we have are varied on this. Okay. But we understand that what we do, and this is the point of this slide, what we do makes an impression, even if we're not aware of it, they are. They are observing. They are learning. They are watching their environment. That's important. Okay. I want to talk to you very quickly about a couple of misnomers. This is for those of you geezers, those of you who raised your hand and been doing this for more than 10 years. I want to make sure you're clear on some stuff about what a Class C misdemeanor is. First of all, a Class C misdemeanor is an offense defined inside the penal code as carrying a maximum fine, a fine not to exceed $500. All right? But be careful with this. Offenses defined outside the penal code, what's the cap? What's the cap? No cap. No cap. There is no cap on the fine that can be imposed by a municipal court as long as the fines, as long as the criminal offense is not prescribed in the penal code. So, let me give you an example. Now, I heard y'all say 2,000. Let me tell you where y'all are getting that. That's actually from the local government code for certain ordinances relating to fire safety, health, and zoning. That is still a cap. They have set a separate cap in there. But in theory, could the Texas legislature create a criminal offense punishable by a $10,000 fine, no jail time, just a $10,000 fine? Could they do that? Absolutely. Could you file that in municipal injustice court? Yes, as long as the offense was not defined where? In the penal code. That's absolutely correct. Has the legislature done that? Yes, they have, believe it or not. Let's think about some of them that we're familiar with. Think of some that, I'll tell you the ones that you probably have never heard of. Manufacturing asbestos products without proper signage, that carries a, I think that carries a $15,000 criminal fine, fine not to exceed $15,000. Doctor performing an abortion on underage female without parental consent, there's always been a tug of war. Some people want to make that like a felony, and other people have tried to make it a misdemeanor, and it is a criminal offense punishable by fine not to exceed $10,000, but there is no jail time on it. There was jail, and in the last minute, they stripped off the jail and just left the fine, which means that it would be filed in a municipal justice court. Okay, here's another number. 2007 judgments in municipal court totaled. Ready for this? $685,793,685. Okay. Now, I'm going to come back to this in a minute. Sometimes this confuses folks, especially people in the finance department. Okay? It confuses people as to why our courts exist and what the purpose of our courts are. You know, sadly, when you ask certain bean counters in local government why it is that, you know, can they count the reasons why municipal courts are important, they can say, yes, I can think of 685,793,685 reasons. Okay? That's not the reason, but more on that in just a second. Okay, we have certain tools. I want to make sure you're all clear that you can visualize the tools that the legislature has given us. The tools that we have can be described as falling into three categories: probation, deterrence, and remedial orders. Okay, probation is essentially, this is what it is. You admit your guilt, you say you're guilty, or you're found guilty, and then we ask you to do the right thing, and you do the right thing. You do something that's either good for you or good for others, and what we'll do at the end is we will dismiss that case. You will not. There will be no final conviction. Okay, and so the one that we think of the most is a driving safety course. It's a very, very limited, narrow, form of probation that only applies to Subtitle C, Rules of the Road, traffic offenses. Okay, now we have a broader one, somewhat broader. Actually, this is pretty narrow too. Teen court. Most people get confused about teen court. How many of y'all have teen court in your communities? Y'all have a teen court? You know, I think we got to rename this because teen court's not court. You know what it is? It's peer sentencing, and that's what we ought to call it, is peer sentencing. Because, you know what? It's not a real court, and it confuses your city council members, and sometimes it confuses your judge and your prosecutor and everyone else. I literally had a prosecutor who got sworn in, got appointed to be a municipal judge so that he could supervise, so that he could be the judge of the teen court. Do any of y'all see a problem of having your city's prosecutor also be sworn in by city council and appointed to be a municipal judge in the same town that they're prosecuting in? Hopefully all of you see how bad of a problem that is. Why did that happen? They didn't know that teen court wasn't court. City council thought teen court was a type of juvenile court. It's not court. What is it? It's probation. You know, it's, you know, y'all hear about peer pressure. Well, this is positive peer pressure. You're not cool. I'm not cool. Having someone who's closer to their age telling them what they did was wrong and telling them that they have to go do X amount of hours of community service has been shown to change their impression. Let's just not let the little rascals ever figure out that the adults are the ones who have written, who created the consequence grid. You know, all the sanctions are determined by adults. We just use the kids to deal out the consequences. All right. Chemically dependent persons, I bet you've never even heard of this. How many of you have even seen this? All of these sit right next to each other in Chapter 45 of the Code of Criminal Procedure. A chemically dependent person says that if a person has, public intoxication, drug paraphernalia, whatever, you know, any type of criminal offense, really, if they go into a certified drug treatment facility, your court can use proof of completion of drug treatment to dismiss a charge without going through deferred. I have yet to hear of a court that has used this, and that concern. Y'all have? Excellent. 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 Well, I'm glad. That's good. Y'all, this is the first time in 9 years anyone has told me that their judges have actually used it. Y'all sure they didn't do it under deferred disposition? They did it as a chemically dependent person order. Okay. Well, that's exactly what they're talking about. Okay. Now, we have fines. Fines are for deterrence. Okay. Can you get a fine if you successfully complete deferred disposition? No, because that's called a special expense fee, and special expense fees are for successful probationers, okay? Fines are for guilty people who are going to have criminal judgments imposed upon them, okay? And then we also have some authority to issue remedial orders. We also have the authority to issue some remedial orders. Let me give you the one that I think is most common, nuisance abatement. You know, if you've got someone who's got, like, tall weeds in there, you know, your judge can not only convict them, but can order them to remediate it. And if they don't do it, then the city can come in and do it. And then they can abstract the judgment against that property for the costs. Okay? And as time goes on, we're going to see more and more remedial orders. You know, other things that we have is we have restitution powers. We have the ability to order restitution. It's unlimited now, which I think, on a straight conviction, it's unlimited, which I think is a horrible policy. We don't need unlimited restitution in these cases. I am scared to death that we're going to have some, how shall I put it, perhaps slightly shady, unethical lawyers trying to use Class C misdemeanor traffic offenses to help their clients get brand new cars. Rather than suing civilly, they're going to go to municipal court and say, hey, this guy got a ticket for failing to maintain a safe distance. We want restitution in the amount of $32,000. It's already started to happen in certain parts of the state. I knew it wouldn't take too long. The lawyers to figure out. You give them it's like water, man. You have a crack, it'll find a way through. Okay. So, any question on the tools? Any questions on the tools? Any questions on anything we've discussed so far? Yes, ma'am.
Okay. On the probation for deferrals, if you get that special expense fee, if they don't comply, can we turn that back into a fine?
Okay, good question. The question is on the special expense fee, if they don't pay it, can we convert it back to a fine and keep it? Well, if they didn't pay it, how can you keep it? Remember, as the law is currently written, when is the earliest you can collect a special expense fee? I know someone in this room who's preparing, who's in the clerk certification program, is going to know the answer to this. What's the... Actually, it can't be collected till the very end. Yeah, you cannot collect it till the very end. Now, during the probation period, you are allowed to make them post a bond. And they can agree in writing that at the end of the probation period that their bond will be converted to cover the special expense fee. But right now, you cannot collect that special expense fee till the end. Let's think about how it works. In deferred disposition, I find you guilty. I impose a fine of $500, and I suspend the imposition of that fine for a period of 6 months. And during that period of time, you're going to go to anger management. You're going to do so many hours of community service and what have you. And if you do this, then at the end, rather than imposing the judgment, the court will assess a special expense fee of X. We have to wait for the period to come to conclusion to know which is it going to be, fine or special expense fee. Okay. Now, how many of you, that is how you understand the law? That's how you, okay. Because guess what? That's changing on September 1st. You will now be able to assess a special expense fee and collect it any time during the probation. But if they blow it, you will have to deduct that special expense fee from the amount of the fine that was imposed. Now, how many of you like that change in law? Because you, okay. I'll tell you, I think half of y'all are doing it already, so I don't think y'all should care that much. That's just me. I could be wrong. All right, now. Questions on this? Let's move on. Okay. You have certain enforced... Yeah, yes, sir. Excuse me? You could still do it the old way. Yes, sir. And in fact, I have to be honest with you. I'm going to have a hard time with this law. I really am, because part of it is when you accept that money up front, it's almost like you're gambling that they're not going to complete it. And I think there's something to be said about, wait a minute, I prosecute a lot of ordinance cases, and I love to do this. I'll ask the judge for the maximum fine, which is like $2,000. I'll give you a real case, a septic case. And then, you know, bad septic system. Fine them $2,000, suspend the fine, special expense fee is $800. But they have to prove to us that they spent $1,200 fixing their septic system. And we gave them 6 months because we don't want to break the bank. I mean, do you see what I'm saying? What we wanted was compliance. And if we had said, all your special expense fee now, I understand from a court administrative perspective, the change in law is going to be very popular, I think. Okay, but in terms of changing people's behaviors, what we were doing was working. So if you like the old law, then just make it, you know, the policy needs to be, we're going to require special expense fees at the end. Okay? Y'all could still do that. Okay. Okay, how do we enforce our judgments? And this is important, too. If you don't enforce, I mean, how many of you have kids? Have you learned this? If you have a rule and you don't enforce that rule, you're better off not having any rules, right? Okay, same's true in criminal law. And so how do we enforce our judgments? Well, we have different flavors, and I want to make sure this is a convenient way to look at this. Another big picture, okay? We use what I call active enforcement, which we actually send peace officers out there to execute writs on these people. The writs result in a Fourth Amendment seizure. Their bodies are seized by the government for a period of time. And that has come in the flavor of being an arrest warrant or a capious pro fine. Okay? How is a capious pro fine different than an arrest warrant? That's actually body for, not body or, body for money. They shouldn't be able to pay their way out. I know half your cities will let them buy their way out at the end, but that's not what pro means. Okay? What do you have to have before you can have a capious pro fine? You got to have a plea. What else do you have to have? You have to have a disposition. And how are we going? What's that really mean? Disposition. I'm looking for a certain word here. You got to have a judgment, because the Court of Criminal Appeals has said if you arrest someone on a copious pro fine and you have no judgment, that's an illegal arrest. Okay, so that's copious pro fine versus warrant. I like this term passive enforcement. How many of you are using the DPS OmniBanks program? Are y'all using it? Yeah, I like Omni. I think it works well. Are any of y'all using TxDOT's scofflaw program yet? Okay, you are? Okay, and is it working for you? They just implemented. I got to tell you, scofflaw program has got some problems. First of all, what this does, rather than blocking you from getting your driver's license, it blocks you from being able to renew your registration on your automobile, which in a certain way is better than Omni, because with a driver's license, you can go 6 years before you're, or 7 years before you have to renew. And so the problem with scofflaw is that only three governments can put a hold, and if you're the fourth in line, it doesn't work. Secondly, there's nothing that compels the tax collector from honoring the hold, which is really poorly thought out. Your tax collector could say, oh, it's you, Martha, I know you, you're still getting it, here you go. And that's not good either. I mean, that DPS is not going to say, oh, yeah, Martha, no problem, here's your driver's license. That's not going to happen. So that's what I call passive. Why do we call it passive enforcement? Because you've got to be patient, and because you're not going out and seizing anybody. You're just kicking back and waiting. You're waiting them out. You're the fourth city in line? Right now, the way scofflaw is designed, the software only has a place for three governments to put in a hold. So if you're the fourth government to try to report that this person has, you know, FTA'd or didn't pay a fine or what have you, there's no place to put your name.
And then the tax assessor collector?
We'll never know.
What
I'm saying is this. Let's say that I get a speeding ticket in your town, and in your town, and in your town, and in your town, okay? And you report me to scofflaw, 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 your report's never going to show up, because the computer can only hold the names of three local governments. So, you know, if it's Travis County, City of Austin, Williamson County, okay, well then Denton County is out of luck. And I'm saying that's stupid. That makes absolutely no sense. In the OmniBase program, every one of us could put a hold. They could have hundreds of holds.
Why is the tax assessor collector not?
Because the law doesn't require them to. It says that they may. I agree. Poorly lit and registered. I think you need to call your state representative and your senator as soon as you get home and say, we demand that you fix the scoff law program because it's important to the operation of our judicial system. All right. Private enforcement, collection firms. How many of you are using collection firms? I think they have their place. I don't like them pre-judgment. That's just personal opinion. I'm soapboxing on this one. Post-judgment, I got no problem with them. Civil enforcement. Have any of y'all ever abstracted a judgment against a defendant in your court? You have? Did it work? Absolutely. Okay, now let me make this clear. There's a time for all things under heaven, and it does not work in all cases. This works in cases in which the defendant has real property. They own land. They have a house. Okay? And I don't know if you can abstract a judgment against an automobile. That would be an interesting question, too. But what it does is essentially it says that when a person is trying, I don't know about cars, so let's just stick to houses. That's where I know it works. Someone has a house, someone has a lot, okay, and they have fines, and they haven't paid them. You abstract the judgment against the real property. When they try to sell that property or their estate tries to sell that property, blip, guess what? It's barred. They can't sell it. Not until they have first provided proof that they have paid the government money that's owed, then they can sell it free and clear.
They were talking about this in level one last night, and so it's only on land property?
Real property,
like,
yeah.
You can't go take your
No. This is not a seizure order. This is a lien, okay? You're basically obstructing, and I don't even think it applies to anything but real property. I don't know about cars. Where I know it works is, it works against slumlords. It works against, you know, people who are not taking care of their property. But if they don't have a home or they don't own land, it's not an option. It's not an option. All right. How do good things go bad? This is how I'm going to wind this thing down because we're almost out of time here. You know, how do good things go bad? I think every one of you can think about something in your life that would start off good. Okay? You know, for some of you, you might be thinking it was the beginning of my presentation. We've gone south since then. Or perhaps it was something else. Maybe it was, dare I say, your first marriage? Maybe it was that first sweetheart you had. Think about it. Think about how you felt about that person. It was wonderful. It was great. And then what happened? Wah, wah, wah. We know how that happens. Our society is fixated on these things. We love stories where something starts off pure and genuine like a snowflake and things go south, okay? Here's an example. You start off as a cute little kid who can fly pods around, okay? Then you become an angry Jedi. Then your eyes go crazy like the devil. Next thing you know, James Earl Jones is doing your voice, the same voice that appears on CNN. It happens, okay? Okay? How good things go bad. Same thing's true in municipal court. I believe with all my heart that municipal courts are good, okay? The institution, the potential, the things that we can do are good. However, things can go bad. And I'm going to talk to you here. Judicial independence is a good thing. Judicial independence is a very good thing. But it can go bad. It can go bad. First of all, people can confuse it with other things. Okay? It's not playing politics. Okay? It means that courts have to be above that. We don't play politics. People want neutral venues to try their disputes in. If you are so concerned about what the city manager thinks or about what the council thinks, that's playing politics. That's not judicial independence. It's also not rubber stamp justice. If people honestly believe that when they want to try a case in your court that they're absolutely going to be found guilty and they have no chance of prevailing, that is not judicial independence. Okay, it's not cronyism. Okay, that's the big attack that people have always had against municipal courts. The judge is always a friend of the mayor. The council only appoints people who are going to rubber stamp cases. That's not judicial independence. It's also not unaccountability. I have some municipal judges who honestly think that judicial independence means that they should never have to appear at a city council meeting, that they should never have to be involved in, in giving an update about how many cases have been filed in the court. That's not judicial independence. And it's also not separation of powers. This is a little confusing, but let me make sure y'all are clear on this. Separation of powers is what protects the judiciary from the legislature and the governor of the state of Texas. Okay? In other words, that's the separation of powers that our Texas Constitution contemplates. Does separation of powers protect you from the mayor and from the city council Absolutely not. It does not, because they're not the governor and they're not the Texas legislature. You're part of the state judicial system. Your municipal court is part of the state judicial system. So what does protect you from overreaching city managers and city council members? Judicial independence is what protects you. Okay. Now, the rule of law, and this is important for clerks, the rule of law is why we're here. The rule of law, however, is not moving the docket. If you are so focused on closing files out that you are losing sight of the fact that these cases impact, you know, public policy issues, people's individual rights, people's interest in their money, okay, people's interest in their reputation, it's not moving the docket. I think that especially, are any of y'all from larger cities, anyone from a big city? Because the larger the city, the more pressure you're going to feel on this. You know, if you work in the Dallas, Houston Municipal Court, that's like, it's like working at a GM factory, okay? Maybe not right now. I'm not sure the GM factories are working right now, but I'm saying, okay, I'm saying that it can be tough, all right? Now, finally, this is why we're here. Quality of life. When people ask you what are municipal courts about, this is what I would suggest to you is the best answer. The, you know, yes, the things that we're dealing with, I know it's not CSI Miami. I understand this might not be sexy. But you need to understand that these are quality of life and public safety issues. These are the things that make your town or your community places that other people may want to live. It also affects the reasons why people would like to leave. I want you to imagine this. What would it be like if everyone in your town decided to stop mowing their yard? What would it look like in your... Have y'all seen that show on like the Discovery Channel, like 20 years after man, and you get to watch like the earth absolutely dissolve? We had that happening in Texas towns, rural Texas. That's happening throughout the entire state of Texas. How do you stop it? Through code enforcement, through responsible, through policies that make people accountable for maintaining their property, okay? And so quality of life and public safety. You know, when I first started working at the center, I had this judge in Tyler say to me, he goes, you know what, Ryan? One guy peeing on your porch, that's nothing. 50 guys peeing on your porch, you've got a problem. And it took me like 3 weeks to figure out what that guy was even talking about. But what he's saying is that in the aggregate, if everyone engages in these, quote, not a big deal, it's a big deal. Let me give you one more example. What would happen if we can all just make a vow that when we leave this school, none of us are going to use our turn signals? Promise me, no one will use their turn signals and no one will stop at stop signs. Which one of you wants to be the first one to leave this hotel? If we all will agree to this, that everyone will speed, no one will use their turn signals, and no one will stop at a stop sign, how many of you really want to leave this hotel? Do any of you? I don't think so. Okay? Quality of life, public safety. And guess what that is not? That's not cash register justice. That's not money. That's not show me the money. So if your finance director, your city manager, honestly think that that's why these courts exist, and I know they do because there's too many of them that do, even if it's 10% of the cities in the state, that's too many, well, you can tell them to give me a call, okay, because I'll be happy to give them the short course, all right, because I think that all of you ultimately appreciate that in your lives, there are so many things that are ultimately more important than money. All right, thank you very much. I'll talk to you later.
All right, thanks, Ryan. Before we take our first break of the morning, I've got an exciting announcement. If I see you've got your breakout sheets ready. If you would turn in your breakout sheets before we come back, we are going to, after we compile the breakout sheets and see who's going where, we are going to put the breakout sheets in a nice big jar, and we're going to have a drawing at the end of the seminar. The nice folks at the end of the hall, Southwest Wholesale Jewelry, MCM at the Elegante, or the Elegant, have donated this beautiful bracelet. And I don't have a QVC hand, but I'm going to walk around with it. It is garnets and opals. And so we are going to take your breakout sheets, and we are going to draw. We're going to have to share with the judges, which I took issue with, but Mark insisted. And so, and oh, yeah, okay, I wasn't going to say that, but but we are. And so fill out your breakout sheets, and we're going to draw for this beautiful necklace. We're going to take a 15-minute break and see you back here. Oh, we're probably running a minute or two late, but we'll aim for 9:30. Anybody want to see this? Patty's out there, she long blonde hair. She will be taking those, and if she's busy, Pat will grab them. It's valued at $300 to $500, they say. Isn't that pretty? It really is.